Thanks so much, Jake. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. So you all caught that in the back. The good news is Kalani will be here on the premises in 5 minutes. But by the time he parks, it'll be another half an hour before he gets up here. Hey, really, I apologize. I'm not Kalani Sitake. It was a few months ago at the Capitol, I was hosting a group of fifth graders who came up to the Capitol, and I was so excited to see them, and I came out to talk to their group, and they gave me a standing ovation, which I thought was kind of remarkable for fifth graders. And I told them to sit down, and I threw them my kind of flashed my shaka, and they stood back up again for a second standing ovation. And I thought, man, I really have to commend this teacher for his civics lessons. Attorney General's not usually greeted that that way. And then the teacher came over and said, "Hey, AG, don't let it go to your head. They all think you're Kalani Sitake, and if, maybe you could just tell a couple football stories. We'd be good." Before Kalani gets here, I've got a lot of stories, but I wanted to share a little bit of insight on a part of Kalani's life that probably most of you wouldn't know about and kind of how it reflects on what I think he's doing today. Just to set the scene for you, after graduating from BYU, and I have my amazing wife, Sasha, here. We graduated both in 1994. Can you just wave, babe? Sasha, she's incredible. Just want to... She helped take care of Kalani. You'll hear the stories. So I was at Berkeley after Provo. I don't know. Let that sink in for a second. So with this growth, there's no way I could take a test in Provo. And it was really an adjustment. I could tell you horror stories about what the Berkeley campus was like, but I'll give you just in a microcosm one experience when I first got there. So when I got to Berkeley and took my first test in their testing center, I was so accustomed to the BYU testing center where they'd check with the credit card. I said, "Sir, is there an honor code?" I'm like, "Is there any clothing requirement here?" And I'm showing him my shorts. I'm like, "These may not make it all the way down to the bottom of my leg." And he kind of looked at me funny and he said, "Clothing requirement?" He said, "We prefer if you wear clothes during the test. But if you decide not to, you have to sign this one waiver." Because apparently some people who went clothing optional then later on tried to argue that they were under duress or they couldn't concentrate, and so Berkeley was trying to... That's the kind of environment we were in at Berkeley. The naked man was walking around Berkeley. Crazy folks, there was more marijuana there. And I grew up part of my upbringing in the state of Hawaii, and there's a lot of marijuana there. There's more marijuana than you could ever imagine. There's this dark cloud that just sort of hangs over the entire city of Berkeley, but it's legal there. And so while we're there, Coach Tom Holmo, our incredible BYU athletic director, is the head football coach. Steve Young's winning some championships for the 49ers with Bart Oates and Jesse Sapolu and others. It's a great time to be there as a BYU alum in Cal. And all of a sudden, I'm the ward mission leader there on the campus, and transferring in is this wide-eyed missionary with the most infectious grin, and his name is Elder Fifita, plays fullback for BYU, and all of us we're looking at him and we're like, man, this guy has no idea what he's in for. He just drew the worst assignment in the entire Oakland, California mission. The Berkeley campus, this is like Sodom and Gomorrah. Good luck. So I'm assigned to take him around on splits, and I'm telling him, trying to manage his expectations, Elder Fifita, this is going to be harder than any place you've ever been. And he was in some hard areas. He didn't care. He said, "Sean, we're going to baptize this whole campus." And I'm telling you, the love that he had for everyone on that campus, the absolute light that he reflected, the light of our Savior Jesus Christ, not judging anyone, not empowering them or enabling some of the things they were doing, but just loving them was incredible. We went on together to baptize the backup quarterback for the Cal football team, an Olympic water polo player, a football player, another basketball player. Incredible experiences. And Elder Fifita, at the time, I said, "If you can recruit for the Lord here in this environment, you should definitely be a coach. I mean, football is your future." And interestingly, he said, "You know, I'm kind of interested in law." And I said, no, the last thing we need is another lawyer. I got that handled. I'll take care of the Polynesian lawyer side. And I'm glad when he came back. I think he became a graduate assistant for Coach Edwards after a distinguished BYU football career. Interestingly, he came back and changed his name from Elder Fifita to Elder Fifita Sitake, and then at some point dropped the Fifita and has been known ever since as Kalani Sitake. But the people who know him on the football field can appreciate the talents and the skills that he brings to the gridiron. But what they may not see all of the time, I think you can still feel it on the field, that infectious love that he has for everyone that with whom he interacts. But to see him in that environment, break down barriers, to see him represent our Savior, represent the church, represent that tag that he wore was incredible. And if you talk to people in the football industry, they will also tell you that beyond the wins and beyond the X's and O's, the building of character that he's able to infuse in each of his players is unparalleled. I think when he was a position coach and even a coordinator for various fantastic institutions, he never lost a player. He graduated all of them. And here's a final story I'll tell because I want to give Chad Lewis some time to be able to properly introduce Kalani and share a story or two from his.
Keep going. You're doing good.
Yeah. I coach a lot of Little League teams, and I've brought them here to meet Coach Witt and the Ute football team, and I love Witt. And the Ute football players have been generous. They let the kids watch during practice. But afterwards, you know, there's a lot of flexing and posing by the players, and they're just having fun with the kids. These are 12-year-old kids, 11-year-old kids, and they're signing autographs, but a lot of selfies. And it was interesting because when I took them down to Provo and let them watch one of Kalani's practices, when the players were done, all 100 of them, whether they were dressing or not, lined up and came by one to thank each of these young kids for coming to watch them practice. They were so humble. They were so appreciative. And they would stop and allow the kids to take a selfie, but they weren't flexing. They weren't posing. There was a humility and there was a spirit there that my 11 and 12-year-olds noticed and said, Coach, like, we loved going to the U, but there's something different here at the BYU practice. And again, I'm not here to say one's better than the other. It's just different. And I think that difference is reflected a lot in the leadership that Kalani brings. So some other time I see him rolling up. Chad, I'm going to bring him up. And I can tell you, Sasha and Coach Holmo, we had to watch out for him when he was there. It was a dangerous environment. But I'm telling you, that missionary that could recruit for the Lord on the Berkeley campus has turned into an incredible emissary that we're so proud of, not just here in Utah, but around the world. So, Chad, come take it away and introduce Coach Sitake. Thank you.
John, you could have kept going. That was good. Kalani, if you come up and just stand by me, that'd be good. Is John going to come in? Because he can. He's probably parking your car. Okay. Well, I'm not going to waste any time introducing Kalani because you're here to hear him. And I'm glad he's here. He's had a busy morning. But everything Sean just said about Kalani and his heart and who he is, that's why we're so grateful that he's the head coach at BYU. He's a beast. He loves people. And he's got a passion for people, for football. And it's my honor to introduce Coach Kalani Sitake.
Thank you. Thank you, Chad. Thank you, Sean. It's an honor for me to be here. It usually takes me a little longer because I have to get out of my comfortable clothes and get into this stuff here. So knowing how uncomfortable I am in proselyting clothes, as we called it on the mission, it's only makes sense that when I became the head coach, I'm like, okay, no more dress code. I'm going to just go in coaching stuff. But for me to be called to a bishopric in the student ward was, I think, God's way of just laughing at me. He has a great sense of humor. So, but it's an honor for me to be here and to discuss a couple things. I know that we're going to have a Q&A portion, and you know, we're talking about morals and ethics and leadership. It was one of the things that was brought to my attention. I read a lot of books, and I try to study as much as I can as a coach, and a lot of it goes into the business world and into leaders that I value. I mean, there's a book that I really like that Daniel Coyle wrote. It's called The Culture Code. He also wrote one, The Talent Code, that I thought was really cool. And I thought, man, if I took all these ideas and brought it up here, at least I sound really smart. But I thought that it wouldn't be as, like, what I value the most, which is just the appreciation that I have and the gratitude I have for so many people that always cared for me. And I've said it before, I'm the product of a lot of other people's hard work and sacrifice. And so two of them you heard from today that have spent so much time in helping me and being good friends and good role models and advisors to me. But there's been so many others, namely Lavelle Edwards, has been, before he passed, has spent a lot of time with him, you know, and then as one of his last captains, it's an honor for me to be around him so much. And I've had a lot of great mentors along the way, even in the coaching profession. And it'd be hard for me to be up here and to talk about what I value the most and who I am without mentioning all the people that have had a hand in who I am today. And probably the biggest influence in my life, though, is my wife, Timberly, who... she's always busy. She's a perfect example of humility. She should take a lot of credit for everything that I've accomplished, and yet she doesn't really care to be in the spotlight ever. And she does this, and she's so unselfish in so many things that she does, and just gives me such a different perspective on how much power the women in our church and in our lives have. And I think for every man in this building that they can probably look at mother's influence and a wife's influence to help them get to where they're at. My wife saw things in me that I never thought possible. Even being the head coach at BYU, you know, there's times that I felt insecure about things, and she filled me with so much motivation and power and strength. So I try to get her to come out here. She just doesn't like when I talk about her a lot. So I do it when she's not around, because if she were here, she'd be really embarrassed. I think it'd be impossible for me to mention how I wouldn't be here if it weren't for her and a lot of other people's love. Someone that I value the most, and I thought it'd be cool to, other than my wife, someone that you know, made a lot of sense for me is like my father. I was raised by a single father. I didn't have a mother in my life. 6 years old, my mom left, and I didn't see her again physically till I was 24. And so my mom has never really been involved in my life, but... just thankful that the other women have stepped in and have taken that maternal role, Patty Edwards, others that the coaches' wives and other people that have really just put me under their wing and given me, I felt like even though I didn't have a mother, I had tons of influences that were surrogates for that. And so I'm appreciative for all the women in my life. But I want to talk about my father a little bit and talk about I think it would be cool if I can quote all these books and things that I've learned and things that were other people's ideas, but I want to just give you an example of how I was raised. When I was 11 years old, my dad had a job in this company down in Spanish Fork. He was a custodian, and it wouldn't be out of the ordinary for my dad to come home, and he worked a couple jobs. That was one of them, but he'd come home and ask for help. For me and my brother, and we would go with him back after hours and do some work because it's easier to clean things up when no one's around. And so we did that occasionally, probably once or twice a week, and I thought it was a lot of fun because I can kind of connect with my dad, ask him a lot of questions. He's got all the answers for me, and it was really cool because on this one moment, we went back and the place was trashed. It was way different than what I've normally seen. And me and my brother were kind of puzzled. And when I looked at my dad, I said, what happened? Like, did a herd of elephants come through here or something? Like, it was trash everywhere. And it wasn't that big of an office space, but we could tell that we're going to be there for a while. And so my dad said, well, they had a change happen. They had to lay a lot of people off in their jobs. And so a lot of the reaction was anger. And this is how they did things. And so we spent the next few hours cleaning, flooded bathrooms. People flooded the toilets on purpose. We had to clean everything. It took us late into the night. And I just kept thinking, like, looking at my dad, how thankful he was to do this work. I kept thinking, really happy that we were able to be here and that he had such a great attitude about it. And me and my brother, I mean, we were just like, there's got to be some laws against this, making us do this, right? But it was just really cool because it was like father-son time. We were talking, singing songs. We'd put on the Temptations and sing along with the Temptations quite a bit. And but it was at the end when we were finally done, we're leaving, and then I said to my dad, I said, I'm so glad that you still have your job. And he said, no, Daddy was one of them that was laid off. And he put his keys on the table, and I was really confused. I said, what did we just do this entire time? So on the way back to Provo in his car, he explained to us how kindness is the way to go. And that he knew a lot of those people that had made a mess, and they're way better than that. He didn't want people to think that that's what they thought of him. He didn't want that last image that, oh, this person that we laid off trashed his office. It was important to him to do his job, which is to clean it up, but also to return all the kindness and the gratitude that he had for those people that gave him a job and that always treated him like he was one of them. Taught me a valuable lesson that, at the time I was just learning a lot, you know, and then from that moment on, I watched my dad as he raised me and the little things on always trying to be kind. And for a man that's really big, that can bench 480, is strong and is intimidating, that guy raised us on being kind. And whenever there's a choice, he always said, tough guys choose kindness. That's the hardest thing to do. You know, he's like, it's easy to fight. I remember getting fights when I was younger, and he goes, that's easy. That's what weak people do. Tough guys walk away from it. You know, and there's little things that he did that would always promote his train of thought. I remember one time I dunked the basketball in the game, and it was over someone, and I was so excited about it. And immediately when I looked to the stands, after it was a timeout, I looked over and my dad was just shaking his head. I was like, I know what he's doing, you know. But afterward, it's just like, you don't need a showboat. I would score a touchdown and he would critique me on little things like, maybe you should have given your teammates high fives and hugs instead of walking off on your own and beating your chest. He was really careful to point out the faults that I had in trying to be to be an example and to show as much kindness as possible, even in a violent game like football. And as I try to go through with my life and as I go through a lot of things, I mean, I'm human, so I get mad just like everybody else does, especially at referees. And so whenever you're in an issue with competition, sometimes it drives you to be someone that you're not. And you see a lot of people making mistakes and making decisions that take them away from who they actually are in their core. And I think if we keep our mindset on how we were raised and think about the things that your mother and your father taught you and the people that have been great mentors in your life, it's always centered around something like that, on the goodness of people and seeing the goodness in people, especially in the midst of competition. I think we can lose sight of that sometimes. And so as much as I preach this, it's how I was raised, you know, and it still doesn't come easy. I mean, there's times that I get really frustrated, I get angry, but I think showing kindness is probably the biggest strength that we can have as a leader. And it's weird because people look at it as a really soft and a weak approach when it's actually the opposite, you know. And I think that it also doesn't allow it doesn't give freedom from not keeping people accountable. I think the fact that I've been able to keep this in my mind as trying to be as kind as possible is addressing the problems right away when I see it. It's made me a better communicator with a lot of people that I work with. It's allowed me to find better ways to be creative and try to find strengths in some things that people would think are weaknesses in our program, in our leaders, and in our and our employees. It's given me the opportunity to collaborate and communicate with so many different people in so many different ways, and to see how even something that you think wouldn't ever apply to football does. And it's made me a better person. It's made me a better husband, a better father, and I've still got a long ways to go. So I would urge everyone, you guys already know inherently what's right and how to do things the correct way. I just say lean on that more than anything, especially when it gets in the situation of competition. I think, we've had a lot of experiences in the last few years being at BYU of ups and downs. But I can honestly say the best part of my coaching career is driving home from a game and my son asking, did we win or lose? And that's what I felt like. That me and my wife, as a coach, I was doing things the right way. That I make sure that I'm the same person regardless of the result of a game. And that made me really proud. You know, we happened to win that game, by the way. So, but I think everybody wishes they can go undefeated in life, you know, and everybody wishes that they can win every battle. But I think the most important part is that we just keep working and working together and have a smile on our face. That's what tough guys do. I think it's the part of the strength in who we are as people and who we are as how we were raised. So that's pretty much my message. I take any questions. And if you look at, I mean, I hope you don't think that I'm the perfect example of kindness. I'm not. That's just one of the main things that always comes to mind when I think about what's moral and ethical, especially as a leader, is that I treat my guys with kindness and I treat them with things that Christ, our Savior, has preached to us. And that's one thing. It's not my ideas. There's nothing that I'm doing that's unique or out of the ordinary that I've separated myself from everyone else. It's just I've leaned on those principles a lot more than I think most normal coaches would. And I'm really thankful for that. So thank you very much. Go Cougs. Yeah.
We all have our ups and downs in life. How do you lift yourself up when you're down? When you're in a point where it's down and you feel down, how do you lift yourself back up? Or what would you be your recommendations or thoughts around how to do that?
Well, I mean, for me, it's just I have a really short-term memory. I think I had a lot to do with football, probably. But I joke around because I don't lie because I'm not really good at it. My wife points it out. Every time I even try, she knows. Before I say a word, she knows. And so, and I don't have a good memory. You know what I mean? So I think the best thing to do is like, I think you just move on and find what's most important to you. Me, I love the best part of my day is helping people and being around others. I mean, I'll give you a quick example. When we lost the game, someone decided to go for two against our rivals and didn't work out. You know, we're in the locker room. The team's really frustrated. And I could tell that they're really struggling. I was struggling, right? And I thought it was a great opportunity. I said, okay, what would Lavelle do at this moment? And what would, what would I this is an odd thing, what would the Lord want me to do here, right? And so after a quick prayer, I got up and went to the locker room. I said, hey, guys, listen, bring it up. And we said a prayer. Thank God for the opportunity we had to represent our families and school in that game. And it was an awesome game. And I told them that it's important that after they're done feeling upset because they worked so hard and that the things didn't go their way, for them to leave the locker room with a smile on their face. And because the best part of the game is that they're going to actually see their loved ones who care and love them so much. And I thought that would be the best thing for them. And I explained to them why. I said, if you leave the locker room and you're upset, your parents are going to come take you out to eat. They're going to hang out with you, and your mom's going to ask you questions like, oh, that was a great catch, and you did a nice block, you made a great tackle. And your response is going to be like, oh, yeah, whatever, right? And then your mom's going to keep asking, and you're going to be kind of a jerk, and you're not knowing it just because you're letting the game affect you. And then next week when we're playing a game and your teammate drops the football, your mom might say something like out of character, like, catch the ball, right? Meanwhile, the receiver's mom is sitting next to her and says, tell your son to make the tackle. And then there's this weird feeling going on. You know what I mean? And all these feelings are going on all because they just want baby boy back after the game. That's all it is. I've never seen a mom that's so worried about winning as much as she just can't wait to see her husband can't wait to see their son represent themselves on the field and the family. So I thought it was more important that they understand that. We haven't had a problem with it. And it's weird because people say, well, it seems like you guys get over losses really easily. Thank you. Yeah, of course. The best part of the game is actually embracing your family afterwards and just letting them know how much you love them and you appreciate having the name on your back, and that you hope that they feel really proud of what you did on the field. And that's what we promote. That's what we teach. And it's different than other places, but I think it's the right way to do it. Yes?
So you've played all over the country. And what coaches come to mind that had an impact on you and you just felt something from them?
Well, Lavelle, for sure. You know, Kyle Whittingham, same thing. I mean, I've had, you know, it's weird. It wasn't just Lavelle, but it was his whole staff. They were awesome. I had a great relationship with all the coaches. Even Dick Felt was retired, and I had a great relationship with him. Had a great relationship with Mel Olson, with Chris Pella, to Ken Schmidt, Norm Chow. It wasn't just Lance Reynolds. It was the whole group. So I had all these people that cared about me, and I feel bad because I'm leaving people out, but like Robbie Bosco and others. That, in connection with teammates that I have, it was amazing. I'm just sitting there going, man, I'm just loved by so many people, and they care about me, you know. And so I've had these great coaches, and then I've been able to have a relationship. I don't know a lot of people. I had a brother that played at the U when I was at BYU. And so I had a relationship with McBride, you know, and I still do to this day. It reminds me of Lavelle so much, you know what I mean? And so I have all these relationships with all these coaches and all these mentors, and I can go to anybody about any of things. I mean, Ken Schmidt would be the first to just tell me what we're doing wrong defensively. And just, I welcome it. I love it. I love everybody having an opinion, and I don't get ever offended by it. I mean, fans told me in 2016 that I was making a huge mistake by not putting Tanner in the game over Taysom. And I just told, hey, we're doing our best, you know what I mean? And I wish they would come back and apologize. So. So, but that never happens. But I've said this before. I think I told Chad and a lot of others. I remember being 10 years old and getting mad at Norm Child because we were running the ball too much, right? I'm like, let the guy throw. Let's go down the field and do all that stuff. So I think it's okay for everybody to have an opinion. I want to make everyone happy, and we can do that by winning and the way we play the game.
There was a fun basketball game a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Got things excited. How much did the two sports and the support, or mm-hmm. I wouldn't say hurt, how do they interplay?
Oh, a lot. I mean, I have a great relationship with Coach Pope. And it's actually the thing that I love about what Tom Homo does as our athletic director and his leadership. He has a great staff, Chad's in it, and just great people that know how to connect all the sports together. And so I lean heavily on a lot of those coaches. I mean, Heather Olmstead, Jen Rockwood, those guys are superstars in the coaching profession. You know what I mean? And Sean and Mike Littlewood, all those guys are great coaches. And so it'd be foolish for me not to, you know, try to watch how what works with his girls and things like that. And luckily, I have the opportunity to do that and connect with a lot of people. I mean, Jody Maxfield she's in charge of the Cougarettes. They've won so many competitions, it's crazy. So I've tried to pick her brain on how they handle anxiety when they're performing, you know what I mean? They won national championship. Chad, how many years in a row did they win it? Yeah, so that's a great resource for me to go to and say, hey, how do you guys deal with anxiety or stress or any of the issues that girls might have to deal with when they're performing in front of others, you know? So luckily, Tom has given me all the access to all these wonderful people that I get to work with in connection to the athletic department. But I'm just talking about that. Then you talk about the teachers, the professors, the people in the upper administration. I mean, there's some great people there at BYU that are just adore, man. They're awesome. And so it's been awesome for me to just pick everybody's brain, try to learn as much as I can from everyone, and I'm so happy. I mean, I don't like going to the games as much because I feel like people are watching me too much, and I want to get up and get mad and yell at some people and get everyone fired up, you know, and people behind me tell me to sit down, I tell them stand up, you know what I mean, like stuff like that. I'm trying to be kind as much as possible, but I think that, you know, maybe they should just switch seats with me because I'll stand up the whole time. No, but I think the success of everything that happens with BYU is good for all of us. And You know, I've been in great relationship with Coach Rose and his staff, and so it just makes sense to continue that with everybody else that comes through. And there's a lot of excitement. I wasn't at the game. I wanted to, but I had to. I made a commitment to be a driver and chaperone at the multi-stake youth dance that my daughter was involved with. It just happens to fall on that date. And so I made a promise with God that if I did this, that it would be okay. So as I actually was a horrible chaperone because I was in the parking lot. This is funny. I was in the parking lot watching it on my phone and cheering, going crazy. And then after the game, I look over and there's three other people in their cars watching it as well. So who's watching the kids? I don't know. But it was such a cool thing, you know. It's interesting because Coach Pope had practiced. I went to the Midnight Madness that they did, and they practiced storming the field. It was probably the nicest and politest storming the field I've ever seen. It was really well orchestrated. They had a good line. I mean, I told Tom and Brian, great job, because they kept the opposing team safe and everything, and that was well executed. Less space compared to in football games. So, yeah. What other questions do you have? Yes.
When you talk about those things of humility and kindness you spoke just about a minute ago, and then you coach a sport that you said a minute ago is an incredibly violent sport, it's a different thing. How do you teach those student athletes when to turn one on and when to turn it off and go the other way? How do you help them learn that one or the other?
So I don't know if you ever seen Chad Lewis when he plays, but when he plays in between the whistle, he's mean. He puts people on the ground. Once the whistle's over, he helps them up. That's what we've always done. That's what Lavelle encouraged. And so I think you exercise so much control and discipline doing that. We build it as this is you can do this. You're better than everybody else, meaning that you can handle being able to be aggressive and be physical and at the same time show compassion and help people up and do things like that. You know what I mean? And it's contagious. I mean, it affects other teams. They end up doing it too, and it makes a more exciting game. You know, and I've been part of games where guys are talking so much trash back and forth, and I've been my true freshman year. I remember saying something back to the player and having Eli Herring put his big, thick hand on my shoulder, and it's like, "Hey, we're better than that." And I'm like, "Yeah, he's right." You know, so it's just things like that. I think if you make that your mission and your purpose, that I think everybody wants to win the game. Don't get me wrong, but man, you can have such an impact in the game. Even if it's not in the win or loss column, you know what I mean. And I think for us, it's our part. It's our part of being a BYU football player, part of leading, and also doing it with service. You know, we do a lot of service work, and it matches the guys that went and served missions, and they come home. We have 87 missionaries, so it only makes sense when they come home to keep serving and helping others. And some recruits don't want to do that. And that's okay. They don't have to play for BYU. So it's important that I give them the expectations, the standard that we have here, and then hopefully they meet it. We have an academic and an honor code. Everything that we have certain standards that we have to abide by, and it's such a great privilege to play for BYU, and just like I think it's a great privilege for me to be a coach. So, yeah, that's the easy way to do it. It's just I think you use it as a strength rather than everybody else can just get mad and get angry. It's just that's not anything unique. How about you knock someone down and help them up and really confuse them? Right, like Chad's done his whole career. Other questions? There's one here. Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is there something you personally do the same before every game to prepare, aside from anything you do with the team?
Oh, like personally? Mm-hmm. I just try to relax a little bit, you know. And I don't have any like secret superstitions or anything. I had more when I was a player. You know, there's like weird stuff when you're 18 to 24. You make up reasons why you won the game and stuff like that. And I still do that nowadays with the Jazz. And when it comes to, you know, Jazz playing or the Cougars playing, I mean, I felt like the Jazz haven't been performing very well because I haven't been watching them. And you know, so it's just like little things like that. Like there was a streak one time when I went to every Jazz game that I went to, they won. And I thought it was me. I walked in, I was like, "Don't worry, Carl, Stock and Horny, I'm here. You can just go ahead and play." But I, as an individual, no, I try to just relax. I feel really confident. I think all the preparation is from the week before, or, you know, week leading up to the game. I feel confident going into it. I think the most important thing I could do as a player, as a coach, is to get with the players and put a lot of confidence in them, you know, just, and more about having fun and going out there and playing at their best. I think that's more important than when you have, when everything's off stress, like, I'm trying to lower the stress, you know. So in coaching, I think you hear me scream, but it's never anything personal or anything that, like, I'm trying to get guys to listen a little bit more, right? So something as simple as, like, catch the ball. You know, when a receiver drops the football and you say catch a ball, you do nothing for instruction. And you're just stating the obvious, right? And so you do nothing. You have to give them solutions. So if something happens, you have to have a solution ready. And so saying something to the player like, hey, you're trying to turn and run before you actually catch the ball. See it in, right? That's an improvement, because then he's going to be excited. He knows what he did wrong, right? And when next time he goes out on a route, he's going to expect you to catch the ball. That compared to saying next time you drop one, you're out. Which one's going to be wanting the ball the next play, right? And I think leading through fear and having, like, these statements of, like, get this done or else, that just doesn't work. You know, and then I think there's a, if someone all of a sudden knows that you're not happy with their performance, and that's the first they're hearing of it is mid-season, then there's something wrong there. And then the concept of us in the competition, I've had to make some tough decisions and who to play and who to start, and the easiest way to do it is the best play. That's the way it works for me, you know. And when something's not going right, then it's quick to fire and slow to hire. That's how I do it, you know. But the best will play, and the best will whoever's performed the best. And it doesn't matter if you're a senior or you're a freshman. I think I have to provide an environment where the best can thrive, and the competition will allow them to thrive. And I can walk through a room full of parents with my head up and look everyone in the eyes, because they know the standard that I set and how their son can play more. I think that's one common question parents want to ask coaches: what's my son doing wrong? How can he play more? Oh, you definitely know when it comes to me and our coaching staff. That's our job, is to communicate that with their son and then with their parents also. Yes. A lot of different ways. I mean, I'll be honest with you. If you guys can be around our team more, that'd be great. I just the accessibility of having, like, great leaders around them. I want my guys to see people that are successful and do it the right way. Right now, they're so focused on the NFL, and I want them to be, right? But I want them to see what life is going to be like after, when their hair starts to fade away and when they're getting a belly like I am, you know, when you eat a crouton and you add 2 pounds for some reason. You know what I mean? Can't eat five bags of Doritos and not gain a pound anymore. But I want them to be around good people and good leaders. And I think you're talking to philanthropy or athletic donations, and yeah, money is great, but I think it's just more than that. I think, like, a more investment as far as any chance that you can be around our players and just to share a kind conversation and have, like, a quick, like, word of encouragement to them. I think a lot of our guys are just, they're still wondering. When I was a player, I didn't know that there would be a lot of options for me. I thought football was it. I didn't work out when I got hurt in the NFL, and then I said, well, I'm going to go coach because that's pretty much what I know. And not that that's a bad profession, but I didn't have a lot of options. And so when I got the head coaching job, I wanted to make sure our players have options to meet people and have opportunities and job opportunities. If you want great great workers and great employees, then come to BYU and check out the people that live in the spotlight and live a disciplined life, you know. And the young men and the young women in our school are awesome. I mentioned that I was in the student ward bishopric. It's just given me such a much cooler perspective on the young women. They're so awesome. I'm so glad I married one of them at BYU, and I met her at BYU. And so, you know, I think you got some superstars that are going to be great employees for you, and I think it'd be really good for you guys to come and have a relationship with them and even just say hi. And I like to point out to our people, like, who the leaders are. And I think we've been working that a lot, right, Chad, getting more of the people in there. I know Sean's been to a bunch of our practices. They all know Sean, you know, and so I think that it's like a common thing. I would welcome everyone to come around and just interact with our players. We have 123 of them, so there's definitely a bunch of people that are interested in what you do. And more than anything, I just want to see the type of people that you are, the leaders that you are in the community, and the wonderful things that you do as mothers and fathers and husbands and wives. Yes?
Tell us a little bit about your current expectations for the upcoming season.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely not happy with any year, really, unless we do what I think we can accomplish and be at our best all the time. And finding consistency in greatness is a difficult thing to do, but hope is not a strategy. That's never been one for me. And so we've done some things and we've changed some things, and I expect our guys to use our competitive advantages and widen the gap between us and other schools. I think I've said it to them that we have to be the best in the world at certain things, you know what I mean? And for them to expand on that and to find ways to widen the gap between them and their opponents. And it really doesn't have to be the best in the whole world. It just has to be 12 opponents, 12 teams that we have to be better than. But at the same time, I need them to grow as close as they can together. One thing that we talk about in our culture is to love and learn. And we've learned a lot of things. I think it's going to make us a better team. We have a lot of guys coming back, a lot of upperclassmen leadership that I think will help out. And we'll see what happens. But my expectation isn't for them to win games. It's for them to play at their best. If they play at their best, then we'll perform really well. And for them to really work together. I think, it's when we made the change, I remember when Tanner was playing for us and we made the change to start Zach. And a lot of people were like, oh, how's that going to go? I wasn't really worried about it. I wasn't worried about it because I knew what kind of person Tanner was. I knew how he was raised. And I knew the things that he'd already shown to me in the past few years. And he became another coach for Zach, and he was there for him. It's what we've kind of been missing a little bit from that, having him be a good mentor to him. And so now that Zach's going to be a junior, I think the competition and everybody else will get him right. But that was something that was missing, and that's a huge part is Tanner's willingness to keep working. He could easily just fold a tent and said, nope, I'm done. I'm not going to be starter anymore. I'm not going to be useful. Instead, he had a great attitude like, all right, how can I help the team? And how can I be the best possible Tanner Mangum for this team? And he did it. And I think he's thriving in his leadership and in work now, because that's the type of guy he is. But we have tons of those guys. We have everyone on our team fit that profile. They're not all perfect, but man, I love them. I love them, and I see so many wonderful things that they can do, and it's just not limited to football. So I could see the stuff that Lavelle saw in me, and it's interesting. I met with Lavelle in the last year of his life. Was my first year of his job, and we never really talked football. He's always talked about service, his testimony, and his belief in me and as a person, and how proud he was that the father that I was and the husband that I was. It's like, oh my gosh, I love this guy. I miss him. Thank you. Love you guys. Thank you.